I'm Dr. Scott Lyons, and you're watching or listening to The Gently Used Human. Have you ever felt the pressure to prove that your trauma is more severe than others, or been around those who have? Situations where people's experiences of pain and suffering are compared and contrasted almost like in a competitive way? Well, welcome to the Trauma Olympics. Joining me today are Kai Cheng Tom, a somatic sex educator and renowned author, alongside Inkem and Defo, founder of Luminos Transforms and the mind behind the Resilience Toolkit. We're diving into the topic of Trauma Olympics, where people compete over hardships, often downplaying or overshadowing other struggles. We'll look at its roots in issues like capitalism, the scarcity mindset, and our need for recognition. Our conversation will cover how this one-upmanship can harm community unity and perpetuate a cycle of endless competition based on personal suffering. What are we doing? Not always intentional, I know. But let's get ready for this profound discussion that sheds light on the complexities and dangers of comparing trauma and the importance of respecting individual boundaries and experiences in the journey of healing and resilience. Let's get this going. Inkem and Kai, my loves, welcome back to the Gently Used Humans. You are the first guest willing to come back. And I just think that talks to your resilience, your sense of humor, and your unconditional love.
And I would I like to. Did you ask other people to come back and they refused?
I will neither confirm nor deny that question. In fact,
amazing.
I can say is I haven't always had the easiest time making friends that come back.
And that's why we have the podcast.
And that's why we have the podcast, to lure them back in to relationship, which I think is kind of the theme of the day. And I would like to start by a test of your unconditional love.
Oh no.
And
why?
But more, why not?
We're just this starting with this right now.
This is the beginning.
This is why guests don't come back.
I don't know.
The ones who are here for their second turn immediately are tested. Immediately are tested for our loyalty.
That's a pattern.
Yeah. Welcome to my attachment style.
I was just going to say.
Embodied in the theme of the show.
Okay.
So I would like to start with a competition.
Oh.
And, you know, a competition, for those who don't know, is a rivalry of two or more parties who strive for a common goal, which cannot be shared, where one's gain is another one's loss.
Can you compete
but
against
first,
yourself?
First, I need to know what's the prize.
The prize is my unconditional love. And
so we've set up a parental dynamic. I'm now competing with my sibling
for love.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds healthy.
This feels like a great start. So the competition is you win the award of my best friend status. So here's the competition. I would like each of you to answer the following question, and only one of you gets the point.
How many questions are there?
There's just two, or maybe three, but probably two. But I feel like,
are you trusting Kai? I have a feeling there's like probably 12.
This is activating a lot of stuff inside of me.
Great, we are rocking the theme in vivo. So here's the first question. Okay, and you will be given a point based on creativity, based on truth, based.
Are you making this up as you go?
No.
Okay.
Are you the only judge? Because I'm going to demand a recount, like right away, just out the gate.
You can also be a judge. How about that?
Can we judge our own responses? We can judge
that's fair.
We can judge, but it doesn't count. Okay.
But judge, how's that in life? So the first question is, as my best friends who are here together, if I was an ice cream flavor, what ice cream flavor would I be?
Pistachio.
Oh, wow. And why?
Are there cacao nibs in it? Because if there's not cacao nibs, it's definitely not Scott. Maybe pistachio cacao nibs.
Pistachio.
Wait, you have to say why. if you want to win the point here, you're going to have to say why. Why pistachio? And you know pistachio is my favorite flavor, but that's beyond that.
Because it's expensive, unexpected, and there's little bursts of sweetness throughout it.
But the cacao nibs just takes it to the next level. It's not chocolate chips. It's raw cacao nibs. Let's be very clear. From Bali.
Wow. Wow. Did you know what?
Did we win?
You both won.
We both won. Yes.
I having to make the decision is too anxiety producing. So I'm just going to say you both won.
But you set up the scenario. Like if it's anxiety producing, it's your fault. Okay.
Yes. Which sets us up for the theme of the day.
Okay.
Because I want to actually talk about a much spicier form of competition that we like to call Trauma Olympics.
Are you going to ask questions?
Are you
on
ready
this
for
one?
It?
Oh my God.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh God.
So are you ready? So the first question is, from your experience, what is Trauma Olympics? Because we've all seen it. We all know it, right? So let's unpack it, operationalize that shit.
I defer to Inkem and Defoe.
Oh, thank you, Kai. Thank you. Well, I'm going to go first, and then if it's an incomplete answer, I went first, so someone else has to round it out. I don't know. Like,
nice.
Nice move, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Trauma Olympics, I see them when, honestly, someone is sharing some kind of hardship, some kind of challenge, and whoever is listening just doesn't have the capacity or bandwidth to sit with that and needs to one-up them to say, like, mine is worse. Like, well, you think you had it bad. Let me tell you. I think that's, like, one way I see Trauma Olympics. But I also see, like, people almost like a reverse Trauma Olympics. Well, I didn't have it as bad as that. That comparison, right, of I can minimize my trauma because someone else had it worse. So I let someone else win the Trauma Olympics, which allows me to not feel what my trauma is because someone else is carrying something worse. So it's one-upmanship or it's minimizing. It's all like no one can sit with their stuff.
Yeah,
I don't know. Kai, did I do good?
Oh my God. Full points. Okay.
Do you notice I didn't ask the judge?
I
asked you.
And because it's the Olympics, so I have to compete. But I think another version of the Trauma Olympics that I see is like when people are in direct conflict with one another. And I see this, I used to say I see this a lot in kind of social justice spaces, but honestly, I'm seeing it in every political space too, like it's including right wing or centrist or whatever. There's a lot of it right now where people are in conflict and then they're saying, oh, well, I am the victim of trauma that you have perpetrated. And then the other person will say, no, I am the victim of trauma that you have perpetrated. And what we see is like this sort of weird empathy override where it's like, well, if you have caused trauma to me, then I win the Olympics and then I'm allowed to do whatever I want. And that's not trauma, it's justice. Or it's not trauma, it's accountability. Or it's not violence, it's blah, 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 right? And we're seeing that play out in a lot of like global contexts right now. I see it a lot in personal contexts. This idea that if someone has caused me pain, then I'm allowed to do anything I want in response, including cause them pain. And it doesn't count morally because I'm the winner of the Trauma Olympics. And that's something that's something I see a lot.
Yeah. What's interesting is that this is actually like, I mean, I feel like we're naming something the more recent of like this phenomenon, but it's actually been academically studied. They call it comparative or competitive victimhood. And the research on it has been really interesting. I think there's something about the fact that we're seeing it more rampantly because there's more platforms to have this competition. There's more rings, so to speak, where this can occur.
So like, what's the benefit? Like, do I really want to win that competition?
Well, I mean, this is what it gets into. Like, where does it come from? Why do we do it?
So there's two answers that pop to mind. And the first is like, I started seeing therapeutic and sociological literature around this that was emergent from the 80s. And it was actually like a response to, that was the moment when like kind of like the courage to heal was on the ascendancy, right? Like there was a movement toward group therapy, essentially, or like personal wellness groups, that kind of thing, where the intention of the groups was to have the group affirm, you know, an individual's process of healing. And then through the group, you know, you would get this kind of amazing benefit, which is true. That is what group therapy does when it's working out. The difficulty was that they found was that people started to make more and more and more intense claims of trauma. And this is where the kind of the recovered memory movement came in as well, where people would start to retrieve memories that seemed in some way to always be upping the ante on a recovered member from another part of the group. And there's a lot of conjecture we can make about that, but I think it is about the group validation or the social validation that we can receive when expressing one's pain is socially sanctioned in an affirming way. And I think the tricky thing is we don't want to stop socially sanctioning that. We want people to talk about things that are genuinely harmful for them. We don't want to set up this escalator where like it feels like there's like diminishing returns. The other piece I'll talk about is more like kind of sociological literature. I've been thinking a lot lately about queer activist and writer Sarah Schulman's work, her book, Conflict is Not Abuse, where she talks about we live in a society where you have to claim that you have been abused to be taken seriously by the social system we live in. And even then, you might not be taken seriously. But if there's any chance that your pain will be taken seriously and your community will offer you care, you have to make an extreme claim. And I think that sets up a dynamic where people then have to make extreme claims against one another. It's kind of capitalist, right? Like, I used to see it all the time working in the nonprofit sector. You'd always try to fund or serve the population that was the most underserved, which creates this dynamic where people have to compete to be like, I'm the most underserved. And we can't just say, actually, it's not a competition. Everybody's pain deserves care, you know?
Or every human deserves care. Like, could we imagine that you deserve care just for existing, not because you were wounded, not because you've had trauma, right? Also. Like it's a set of deservingness that is here. And with capitalism, as you said, Kai, everything is amplified. It has to be bigger. It has to be more. It has to be shinier. And the more crowded the landscape, I think social media has definitely amplified people's need to grab eyeballs, grab likes, grab follows. And so the more I can share, the more, you know, I mean, I think about like the nonprofit industrial complex and how do you get funding? You march out your sob story.
Yeah.
And that is what is going to galvanize funders.
Yep. Same with college admissions, right?
Yeah, college admissions, yeah.
They know you're not supposed to write about a super happy child to get into a college. You have to write about all the terrible things that happened to you.
Yeah. And this brings up like trauma as currency. Mm-hmm. Trauma as the currency for social interactions, for attention, for resources, for all of these things where this becomes the exchange. Like my trauma equates to my receiving a validation or attention or recognition. Mm-hmm. And that sets up, as we're talking about, a danger of having to, in the field of competition for attention, that sets up a very dangerous process of having to constantly one-up yourself in order to maintain the currency of attention or the currency to receive attention.
And I would say, it's also happening in a vacuum where we're not seeing it on the other side. And so it's become in social media, in the nonprofit world, in humanitarian work, right? It's excluded or eclipsed any other way of validating because it has to be so extreme that we don't want the news. We don't want the happy stories. The happy stories don't sell. They don't fund. They don't bring attention. That we've become almost, I mean, it's quite far afield, but many years ago, I studied homeopathy. And in studying homeopathy, there was some very old writing where they said, please avoid any stimulating substances like celery. Like celery was considered stimulating.
Stimulating. Okay.
No, but when I think about now, you know, it's not enough to have like a mint gum. It needs to be supercharged, most intense, icy hot mint thing that's possible. Even the flavors, everything has to be bigger, more than the thing that came before. And so our nervous systems are not primed to respond anymore to the simple like celery. Like we need all these artificial stimulants. And I think that this has taken, it's supersizing what the Olympics, where the natural impulse that Kai was talking about to validate, to connect, to care, has now been turned into, it's been weaponized, supersized, and nobody gets care unless you can really, really prove it that you're worthy. our palate, our nervous system has been so accustomed to high stimulus that it's not enough just to say, I'm human. It's not enough and I deserve care. It's not enough to say that I've been slightly harmed and deserve care. We have to be majorly harmed. And so there's scarce, this idea that there's very scarce resources of attention and time and money and care. And so, of course, if I don't play this game, I'm not getting any of it, whether I'm an individual, whether I'm a nonprofit, whatever it is. I mean, you think about countries trying to appeal for humanitarian aid. It's got to be the most dramatic.
That's really true.
I mean, we've all taught together and seen this in action. And this is not, you know, some shaming quest, but it's intense because there's a certain feel to it when, like, talking about one particular individual or group, and then someone else comes in and says, you don't see me. When it's like, whoa, can we pause for a moment to see who we're working with or who we're speaking to right now before we then turn our attention to you as well? Like, there's not even space in the conversation. It's almost reflexive of like, if I'm focusing on you, Inkim, then that means automatically Kai's not seen. Mm-hmm. Which
it's
is
a zero
like,
sum
which
game.
Is an internal trigger. It's a zero yeah. sum game. Yeah.
Zero sum game. There's just not an, and I think, you know, this is the scarcity mentality, which, yeah. you know, I think capitalism definitely fosters it because it keeps us always consuming, always producing, always striving. Because if we were actually content, we would stop. So we have a culture and economic system that really fans that. There is just not enough to go around.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Have either, well, I'll just say any of us, do we have any personal stories in which, you know, and the transparency and the honesty recognize how we might have participated in some of the trauma Olympics? Hmm. Like just to normalize it too, because it's like we can comment on it, but I actually think it's much more common.
Totally.
In some ways, then.
I mean, I would say, like, for me, there's a part about credibility. If I'm working in the area of trauma, the need to state that I'm a survivor gives me a credibility. I don't know if it's participating in trauma Olympics so much as, because I've kind of moved to this place of now of like really low impact disclosure. I think early on, I needed to say like all the things, right? Like, but it was almost my reflexive reenactment, right? Like I just had to say the thing. And now I do find in certain spaces the need to state it for the certain kind of lived experience credibility as opposed to academic credibility. But I think earlier, absolutely. Here, I've got this thing. That's why I'm here.
I really resonate with that, Inkim. Like, especially the demand, like what I feel as a demand to identify as a survivor, to identify the things that I have survived. One of my really favorite leftist woman of color writers is a person by the name of Yasmin Nair. And I really encourage folks to check out her work, her website. She's done this incredible writing. I think she's one of the first and best writers I've ever seen talking about this phenomenon. She calls it the trauma passport, where she talks about how in many different political spheres, including the left, there's this idea that in order to gain entry into the conversation about oppression or transformative solutions, that sort of thing, you have to use the passport of your own trauma. And if you don't state it, then you're considered to be an outsider to the conversation. And what I really like about Yasmin's work is she acknowledges like that there's a tension there. Like, of course, there's a politic of nothing about us without us. If you're going to be advocating for survivors' rights, you know, probably people deserve to know to some extent whether or not you're a survivor. I don't think it means they're entitled to the details of what you survived necessarily. But there's just this very tricky thing, I think, about like telling people that they, or like creating a culture where disclosure is required to be part of a cultural conversation. Mm-hmm. And I see that so much in like the wellness sphere, the healing sphere, the political spheres. I think social media really encourages this because all forms of disclosure are like heavily incentivized by social media. And I'm really fearful of that. I will say, you know, personal stories, I think I have, well, yeah, one major one is I got really pulled into like the trans kind of identity politics wars of the 2010s. And I don't mean even like the struggle with the right wing. That's a whole other story. But unknown to a lot of people who aren't in the world of trans identity politics or in the world of trans community is that there was, and for a long time and continues to be, like a real competition over who is really trans and who's really experienced the most marginalization because of gender. And you have all these kinds of things, people saying, you know, oh, well, non-binary people don't really experience transphobia. Transmasculine people don't experience transphobia as much as trans women, and the reverse as well. And, you know, I have my own stake in these arguments, but I remember when I started to wonder about how absurd it was getting for me was when I started to, like, I kind of got pulled into this way of thinking where I was like, well, I'm a transsexual, you know, I've done, like, medical transition, and I'm not here for this, like, struggle of, like, transgender people who haven't done medical transition. And I was, like, in that kind of mode for a little while, and then I started to think, this is kind of ridiculous. There are real differences, I think, between different kinds of trans people, just as there's real differences between different kinds of racialized experience. But I just noticed that scarcity mentality and that, like, feeling of competition, like, my group is more oppressed than the other group, so you should listen to us. And then also within that group, there's a smaller group that, you know, like, that kind of looking for the truly most traumatized voice to, like, speak the truth of the world is a losing game. You're not going to find it. And it splinters social movements apart. So that was sort of what got me turned around when it comes to this kind of trauma or oppression Olympics. It was just noticing, like, there's some really negative effects to it. And there's so many reasons why in a world that is, like, actually just, in a world that's actually safe, in a world that's actually healing-centered, that you wouldn't want people to have to disclose constantly the trauma they had experienced in order to be seen as legitimate, because that in itself is traumatogenic.
Mm.
It's interesting as you're talking, Kai, is that I recognize sort of a pendulum swing here when trauma was the field of you had to be an academic, you had to be licensed. Those were the only people allowed to talk about this.
Yeah.
And that really the doctor-patient binary was very strong. And this idea of my lived experience being valuable as a currency of knowledge and wisdom. But there's a difference between it's an additional current, like, so I can speak from my training or I can speak from my experience. But the pendulum, as pendulums do, they have big swings. And so it went, I think, from this really, like, rarefied who gets to talk about trauma to people claiming I have trauma and you can't define my experience. And then as capitalism and our culture likes to distort things, that has become just exaggerated into such a disfigured way where people are now fighting over attention and care, that there's just this possibility there's not enough to go around. There's not enough legitimacy to go around. Like, is there a limited amount of legitimacy? Did somebody say that there's a legitimacy bank and we're overspending it? Like, where is this feeling coming from?
Well, I think it's really scary, too, if we really take that from a clinical or, like, a practice perspective, because if your trauma is your legitimacy and you heal and you no longer feel traumatized, what does that say about healing and whether or not we should do it, you know?
Your identity is gone. People so often, trauma is their identity.
Yeah. And the whole point of trauma healing...
And the giving up of our identity.
Yeah. Also traumatic.
Traumatic.
Yeah,
I want to take a moment to give a loud shout out to The Embody Lab, which is one of the most incredible resources for body-based and somatic therapies. This show is all about healing, and The Embody Lab does exactly that. Whether you're on your own journey of transformation and discovery, or enhancing your skill sets in your career as, like, a coach or a therapist, a body worker, or really any career where you are supporting other gently used humans, the Embody Lab is your place for deep, inspiring, and impactful workshops, certificates, masterclasses, and an incredible community of like-minded folks. I love the Embody Lab. And so do so many other people that call it a platform to come home to over and over again. The Embody Lab is giving my listeners an exclusive offer, a one-time 10% off code to enhance your embodied well-being. All you have to do is go to theembodylab.com and use the code gentlyuse10 at checkout. I mean, I love that we're entering into the nuance. And on one hand, it's like the dangers of it. On the other, the fear of giving it up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's legitimized by what's happening. It's like, as we're saying, it's like, okay, if I don't, and I appreciate it in Kim that you're low impact disclosure. Such a good term. I've always been a very, very low impact, very low disclosure. I think it's part of my education of you disclose the least amount possible for the maximum amount of benefit. Mm. And I got a lot of shit over the years. And I didn't disclose my pronouns. I didn't disclose my past traumas. And I've done more so on this podcast than I ever have anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And it's partly because it's not that I wasn't open to it. I didn't like that it wasn't in my agency, that it was becoming a demand mm-hmm. of me to legitimize my voice or the wisdom I'm offering or the experience I'm offering. And I didn't also want to fucking go into the details of my trauma because that doesn't always feel good. And I have the right to feel good from what we've all experienced in our lives. We have the right to say, I have wisdom, I have experience, and I don't have to give you the details because you need them.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me in many ways of the tensions around the political imperative to come out as gay or lesbian, or in the later days, like as queer more generally. Where, you know, for quite a long time between the 70s and 90s, I would say, there was this strong push in certain parts of the queer community where it was kind of like, for queer justice, you have to come out. And I still see this today, you know, in certain parts of queer and trans community, this idea that like being out is somehow better, like that being out is somehow more developed, that there's like a political justness to being out. And that just feels short-sighted to me, where I'm like, it's actually like it's an injustice that certain people. And I'm a very out person, you know, I'm not all over the place, but like this idea that we should have to disclose really intimate details of our sexual lives or of our, you know, gendered selves to who? Strangers? Like, it doesn't actually feel like a trauma-informed idea.
It's the lack of agency, the lack of choice. I think you both named it really well. There's something I just want to, like, you know, just completely in on the side here. That when I've asked or seen Trauma Olympics happening and there's an image that comes up for me is that if each of us sort of had our cup of capacity, what we can tolerate, and some of us have little thimbles we can't tolerate very much, and some of us have a bathtub or a big wide lake, but regardless of the size, the feeling when it overflows, when it's too much is the same. Too muchness is just too muchness. Mm-hmm. And that transcends whatever it is relative to capacity. And I think that it provides a little leveling of it, and also, but not a collapsing, to recognize that all trauma is not the same. It is true. While everyone, I believe, gets to identify and self-proclaim, this is traumatic to me, we can clearly separate some, you know, from a refugee torture survivor to, you know, I mean, there's a range here. And I don't think we need to quantify that continuum or collapse things and say that they're all the same in saying the feeling of being overwhelmed is the feeling of being overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is such a spicy subject that I'm so grateful. You are the only two people I feel like I could have this conversation with in a way that is humanistic and kind and empathetic and compassionate and nuanced and address it, because it's not healthy entering into this trauma as currency. I was writing about it in my book. I was talking about competitive victimhood, and I was asked to take it out because it was perceived as insensitive.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I was like, on one hand, of course, I was writing about these studies that looked at two different groups of refugees that were in Switzerland. And the fighting between the two groups was so severe that the police had to intervene. Mm-hmm. And they brought in a mediator and they started interviewing each of the groups. And they asked them, like, what do you actually hate? And they couldn't give specifics. It was these general ideas. And when they were able to unpack at the heart of it, what they realized was that they believed the other group was getting more resources than them, even though they felt more victimized. Mm. The behavior was a reflection of the fear and the lack of resources they believed they were getting and deserved based on their trauma.
And my guess is whoever was providing resources did set up a competition in some kind of way. And so the irony here is that here we are talking to traumatized folks saying, cut out the trauma Olympics when we have systems that incentivize the behavior for survival.
Talk about it.
I did.
How do you perceive the incentive?
I just did.
That's not true. I mean, in what ways do you see the incentivization actualizing or occurring?
Well, I mean, if you look at like any competitive grant process from a nonprofit, like, or you have a, I mean, you have a funder who's funding nonprofits, and each of them, there's a limited pot of money, and you've got to say why yours is the most, as Kai said, the most extreme, the most, you know, right? Because then you'll get the money. So we are, everybody's competing for this limited pot of money that was actually originally extracted through gross predatory behavior. I mean, how did people end up with these large amounts of money that they benefact back? Right. Mm. So it's taken from us and then we compete and scrounge against, it's like Hunger Games. This is just basically the Hunger Games.
Yes. I think too about, I mean, we are seeing several contexts of wide scale geopolitical violence right now in the world, like several, right? And like we are seeing in real time, entire communities, entire cultures, entire nation states compete for the sympathy of the international audience. And like, we are actually seeing this is interesting thing to be in the social media era while this is happening, is we'll see communities putting out videos of their own children being grievously harmed, right? And then you'll see like videos comparing or graphics comparing the numbers of children who have been harmed in various conflicts on, you know, any side of like a geopolitical conflict or a geopolitical abuse, right? And you know, it's just astounding to me that that is the world in which we live, where in order to receive international aid, international support, the sense that one's humanity is worth preserving, we're watching people compete over like the number of children who've been killed in international warfare, you know, in their respective communities. Which is not to say we shouldn't look at power dynamics. It's not to say we shouldn't understand that, for example, America like is responsible for huge numbers of global deaths worldwide, and that other countries have, you know, contributed less. We should know that. It's the competition that feels really soul crushing.
Yeah. And the setup of the hierarchy of hurt.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in any hierarchy, like I know we can, on one hand, we can talk about like there's little traumas, there's big traumas, and there's the universal experience of flooding, which means when we've had too much, we've had too much. And at the same time, the setup of hierarchies is dehumanizing.
Yeah.
To say that one hurt is in competition to another hurt creates a separation and dehumanization of the whole.
Yes.
Well, trauma to separation.
Yeah. It's like a disintegration, I think, sort of what we're all kind of landing on here, right? And there's something, when that plays out, that disintegration plays out interpersonally, it has really grave consequences, I think, because when we say one group of people matters and another doesn't, all kinds of things start to happen. All kinds of violences, all kinds of exploitations, all kinds of deprivations. Like in the moment when we compete in the trauma Olympics, we feel like, well, at least if one person wins, then that group of people is the group that's going to be saved, you know, like, or if I compete and I win, then I'm going to be saved. But what really ends up happening is we create a system in which everyone is destabilized and everyone is in danger, and it's much harder to trust one another.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but I'm just like checking into my body as we're having this conversation, and I am sad as shit.
Yeah, I know. It's really heavy.
It's heavy, but it's like, it breaks my heart to think that we have to compete to be seen and heard, and instead of, or compete to get the resources to heal.
Yeah.
But this is, in and of itself is the sign of trauma. Yeah. Like if I were to even want to compete and have that comparison, it's because the disconnection that is inherent in trauma is active in me, where I can't hold the complexity. I can't hold the whole. I can't hold the both and. So it's both a symptom and a cause. Mm-hmm. Mm. And it's the Ouroboros, yeah. Like literally eating its tail. And we're stuck in this. What does it look like to come out of this? That's what I wanted.
Yeah. Well, I would say even before, what does it look like to retire from the Trauma Olympics? How do we know we're in it? Like, if I'm sharing a post on social media, what are some signs or ways that I can help myself or other people start to discern, am I enacting this? Am I participating in the Trauma Olympics? Or am I contributing towards healing and support and wisdom transmission?
I mean, for myself, it means noticing an impulse to exclude, to one up, is going to be an impulse to be seen so others aren't seen, is an indication for me. I mean, I think about times, not necessarily, I mean, there is some trauma in some of the physical health and disability things that I've dealt with that I kept very, very private for a long time.
Yeah.
And when I did finally do a little bit of sharing in social media, how connective it was, right? And then other people came forward and shared their stories in a connecting way rather than it was a Me Too where we joined in together. And that was the sense about it, as opposed to, no, look at me. It was Me Too. And then there was care. You could really feel the currency of care flowing to one another. So I think that we can say hard things and we can say them publicly in a spirit of connecting rather than disconnecting, in a spirit of abundance. But I think, you know, I had to do a certain level of healing and be in a kind of state to be able to do that.
I think for myself, when I notice I might be sharing from a lack, from a deficit, a place of deficit of like where I'm feeling alone, where I'm feeling not seen, not heard, where I'm feeling like someone else is getting something, where there's actual jealousy of resources or of attention, of likes. And I'm responding based on that. I think that's one of the indicators for me.
I have to say, you know, what's come up that I hadn't thought about is I had to force to do a GoFundMe to raise money for treatment. And in that, I felt the need to say, like, this is how bad it is. And this is why I need your sympathy. And this is why I need your money so I can go get treatment. So I think like that whole industry of GoFundMe's funding treatment is just like a case study in Trauma Olympics for resources. Oh, and that makes me feel sad and heavy. Oof.
And I hope you got the money you needed. Yeah,
I got the money I needed and I'm like 95% recovered and I'm so grateful. And what was so interesting is it actually ended up being a very connective experience where people who, you know, I had as a midwife attended births of babies, people who had seen things that I had written or videos I had done or attended classes over like really, you know, well over 10, 15, 20 years were able to say, we are so happy to be able to support you, that there was a sense of reciprocity that came out of it. However, the impulse that I was existing in is in an ecosystem of look at me compared to all these other GoFundMes. Why am I more worthy? And, you know, this is because of a simple failure of our health system or lack of health system in the United States to acknowledge disability and complex multi-system illness.
This really brings up for me the fact that like trauma is a bonding agent. It's a social glue. And it's a difference between when trauma is a bonding agent or a social glue versus a social disruptor, like something that's separating people as opposed to bonding them or bringing them closer together.
Well, you know, there's something so beautiful about the experience you described in Kim, not the having to disclose in order to get your needs met, but the fact that you could disclose. And then there was this amazing web of people. And as I was listening to you speak, I was hearing you say, like, actually, largely, it was like a web of relations that in some way already existed, right? Like there was a pre-existing group of people who had received care from you or like from each other around you, and then were giving care to you. And that reciprocity, that longstanding relationship, maybe is part of what like makes that experience beautiful in that way, is that there's the real presence there before and after, right? Versus like competing for the money of strangers. Or, you know, I've also seen things in communities where we're competing amongst our friends, we're competing with our friends, right, for the money that comes from our communities. And yeah, like I think it's really beautiful when we can reach out and ask and receive the care we need. If everyone could have your experience, not on GoFundMe, but like, you know, through some kind of collective healthcare system, then it would be great. It's not the disclosure itself or the need to ask for help that is traumatizing. It's the fact that it's like it's us or someone else, I think, maybe, that makes it so awful.
And so, I mean, I think what's this is like some compassion that we exist as individuals in a system that incentivizes us towards this behavior. And so what kind of awareness we can have that we're not unintentionally participating in Trauma Olympics? Is this connective? Is this, am I, as you said, Scott, coming from a place of lack? And at the same time, sometimes we do need to, like I did, I needed to raise that flag in a system that I didn't create. And I'm, you know, in some many ways, a victim of. And so someone could say, yeah, you're participating in it. Mm. And so how can I, maybe it's a harm reduction model, right? It's, we're not in the promised land yet. So how can we navigate knowing that these systems pit us against each other? And how can we refuse to participate when able? And if we need to, how can we minimize the impact and make this more of a connecting versus disconnecting experience?
Totally. I think too, there's something about the other side of that, right? Like, when are we like, when, like, sometimes we're in the position of like being the person who gives the money to the GoFundMe or the person who is on the board deciding which programs to fund or the, you know, like that kind of thing. The person in the audience listening to the art, right? This is like Trauma Olympics is like a noted problem in the spoken word poetry community for over, you know, 30 years now. The idea like the poet who says the most trauma on the stage wins. And what does that mean for art, right? So intense. And like really, I think like cultivating the capacity to value people beyond like the titillating quality or like the sensationalist quality of their story of trauma is so important. Like, how do we humanize and like support like the humanity of people who are experiencing pain without having to make them tell their trauma story? Can we treat somebody who has had a bad experience with, you know, the same amount of care as we would treat somebody who's had a terrible experience? Like, being the person who distributes care in one's community, I think, is also a part of this.
This show is also brought to you by the absolutely stunning and powerful tools for transformation that are created by Omala. Oof, even the name Omala transports you to a place of flow and vitality. These are some of my favorite products ever, like an amazing color-changing yoga mat that responds to your temperature and presence and reflects back your posture in real time. They have this incredible smelling skin balm candle that heats up to activate all the essential oils and vitamins that your skin has been craving for. I mean, look, if I could live in a giant bath of this candle, I would 100% do it. They also have these journals that lead you into a profound insight, and then you can plant those journals to create a stunning flower garden. I mean, damn. If that's not both deep and inventive, I don't know what is. If you're someone who desires to live in a luxurious flow of life and who believes in transformative wellness, then you have to check out Omala. Omala is giving my listeners an exclusive discount to treat yourself to something that is as special as you, boo. All you have to do is go to omala.com, that's omala.com, use the discount code DrScott10 at checkout, and a portion of every purchase goes to an incredible charity. You got this.
So it feels like we're kind of entering into the domain of how do we retire ourselves from the sport of Trauma Olympics.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Oh, but first, I'm sorry, I need to give a score. 10. 10. Y'all get 10
across
out of 10.
The board.
10
out of 10. Across the board.
10, 10, 10, okay. 10, 10, 10, 10.
I had to do it before we retire.
That was amazing. 10 for you, and a 10 for you, and a 10 for you.
Thank you for letting me win.
We're all winners. But you won.
We're all winners. But you also won.
Thank you.
You know what? Yeah. That winner's podium is actually really big. We've been convinced that it's like a small little spot. The winner's podium is big.
Totally.
Did you guys, this might not surprise you knowing we've all played board games together. And when I was a kid, I was banned from playing board games by the family therapist.
Did you used to flip the board? Would you flip the board when you were losing?
I can neither confirm nor deny. I cannot. Well, I can't remember my childhood, so that's an easy
that's
one.
That's convenient.
I actually don't remember. I don't remember the why. All I remember.
Oh my God, what a therapist answer. I don't remember my childhood. That's convenient.
But we had to play the ungame, which was the game that you could never win. And had no competition. And it was like, you rolled the dice and then you asked each other questions. And it was like, it's a very Christian game, even though we weren't Christian.
How is it Christian?
They'd ask questions, I think, about Jesus and stuff.
Okay.
Like in Catholic values. It was that type of
game. All right.
And, you know, because I didn't even remember that. Uh-huh. I didn't remember that until I found the game in a garage sale 6 years ago. And I got it. Because I was like, I wonder what it'd be like now that I'm out of my competition phase of life. And it was very religious and very boring.
You know what? I have to say, when it comes to playing board games, my favorite games are cooperative games. And it took me a minute to recognize it. So cooperative games, instead of the players playing against each other, the players play together against the game.
Yes. Yeah, I love those games.
That's like pandemic.
It's a little too soon, please. It's too much on the nose. We're not talking about that game.
What are the other games that we played that are like that then?
There's a game where you have to get off an island. I remember that. I can't remember what it's called. There's several of these games.
I know we played some. Yeah. All right. So how do we retire from the sport at the Drum Olympics? Or how do
people? I vote for a cooperative gaming aspect. How is it that we come together and compete against the game itself that has rigged us to compete against one another? How do we make like this idea of making space, right? Because I think when I've been able to come out of a lot of that in doing my own healing and to be able to hold the complexity and the nuance and make space on that winner's podium for broad, inclusive care.
Yeah, I love that. And I will play that game with you anytime.
Totally, right. Yeah, I'm into it.
Let's do it. There's snacks. There will be snacks.
I love snacks. You had me at snacks, but you also had me at board games.
Is there pistachio ice cream with rock and
I hope so. This is how I know that I'm with my best friends, because they combine my two favorite things. Cacao nib pistachios. Okay. Well, really, chocolate pistachios. Let's be real. I think about too of starting to say, to ask for the underlying need as opposed to act on it through this kind of Olympic process, the trauma Olympic process, to be like, wow, someone's getting some attention. That reminds me, perhaps, if I check in with myself, that I too am feeling the need to be seen, or something in me wants to be recognized that hasn't been processed. And I get to check in, wait, has that actually been processed? And do I just want to be recognized and seen right now? Because the two things are different. I might have already processed that, and re-bringing it up is re-traumatization, is pouring fuel on a fire that actually got to be put out and then lighting it again, by the way, versus really this process of going, okay, do I need attention? Maybe yes, and that's okay. And
attention.
Is something in me that, yeah, who doesn't? And is there something in me that also still needs to be processed? And I can say, hey, Kai, I can call you on the phone. Hey, Kai, hey, Inkem, I just need a witness. I just need to be felt, seen, attended, connected with. Or, hey, something in me is really stirring and coming up. Do you have the time to hold space for me? So that I don't start doing all these things and making other people an other in hopes that I get seen.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I do some like capacity building and training around trauma-informed approaches for like people in healthcare professionals, this type of thing. And one of the things that healthcare professionals often do is they have peer review where they get together and they review difficult cases, which is usually just a bastion of trauma Olympics. And one of the ways that I do training and mentoring around this is to help folks identify, because you can just say do low impact disclosure, but then people have this still this unmet need, is helping them identify what is the need. Do I need to be witnessed? Do I need some piece of information? Do I need like a reassurance I didn't make a mistake? Like, what is it that you need? Right. And then how much detail is needed to get that need met? And that really people feel like so much relief having a roadmap of how to engage in these spaces where you were talking about potentially quite traumatic and difficult cases in a way that generates support and connection and learning rather than going up that escalator of competition. So I'm seconding, Scott, your idea of identifying the underlying need and voicing it, being able to voice it.
I think there's a certain, I mean, I agree. Naming the underlying need, I'm really curious about, like, so I'm a mediator, and I see the trauma Olympics and the oppression Olympics happen a lot in real time, right? And this is a constant question for me. It's like how to get people out of that loop. It's just not helpful for conflict transformation. And as I've been experimenting, you know, with my process, part of what I do is I kind of like create lists of questions or like exercises that I then have my coaches or therapists do to me so that I can see how they feel. And, you know, a couple really powerful questions that I'm still thinking about are, like when we play the trauma Olympics, or when we hold on to a narrative of I'm the most traumatized or I need to be, what is the benefit that we're getting from that? And what is the benefit that other people are getting from that, right? Like, you know, it may not seem like people around us are getting a benefit from us doing the trauma Olympics, but they actually are. Like, for example, not having to talk about their own stuff, right? They are getting to hang up responsibility for their own beliefs or setting boundaries on you in a good way. On a big picture scale, you know, the capitalists are winning, right? Because we are harming one another, we're hurting ourselves. And then the question is, what is the price that you pay to compete in the trauma Olympics? What is the price you pay for holding on to this narrative as the only narrative? And I mean, that's a massively powerful question. Like, if people really go into it, like, we pay huge prices to stay inside of our trauma narrative. And lastly, like, what would it take for you to be okay to let go of it? And people tend to cry when I ask that question, you know? because the answer is, like, it comes back to the need. I'd have to know my needs could be met without it.
Yes. Oof, somebody put that in a book.
The book title.
Those are such powerful questions, Kai. And they do. They elicit the underlying fear that if I attend to my need or if I recognize my need, could it actually be attended to without the device of amplifying my pain?
Yeah. And often we have not had that experience, right? Like, our bodies have learned, like, this is the way, and there isn't another.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, once we get to that truth, we can start to work with it.
I mean, even based on my childhood, my immediate response is, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I have some of the most incredible space-holding present friends in the world, I think. And they're on this call. And I still, there's something like implicit in me, even though cognitively I know the answer is, I could be met. I absolutely could be met. But something in me is still that goes, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. And I think so many of us can probably relate to
that. Oh, I think so. That's why it's so hard. People sometimes even know that they're doing the Trauma Olympics, but man, they cannot let go.
That addiction to drama. Just saying, you walk right into it, you open the door. I just walked through.
Amazing.
Except that I wasn't allowed to write about it in the book. And I understand why. You know, going back to Kai as a, you know, you're both mediators. You both do conflict resolution.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And there's something really interesting because competitive victimhood is a barrier to conflict resolution.
Yes.
And it's amazing that it impedes reconciliation.
Yeah, I mean, also there's like the shame. It's a shame shield too.
Mm. Yeah, it's huge.
You know, the shame of accountability of having harmed someone and another person is I don't have to. If I can, you know, lift up and elevate and highlight and spotlight my victimhood, I don't have to face the shame of doing harm.
Yeah.
This becomes really challenging when there's like a power dynamic involved, because competitive victimhood, like engaging in it, prevents us from being able to see like the intensity of the impact, which of course is the shame shield. We don't want to see the intensity of our impact. But you know, I've worked with a lot of kids, for example, or grown-up kids who were experiencing inappropriate like discipline, like violence from adults. And so many people, kids, have had the experience of the adult telling them, "You're the one who's hurting me," right? Which is, when we put it in the context of adults and children, here in this context, we can say, okay, well, that's, you know, transparently absurd, right? Of course, parents can be triggered by their kids. Of course, teenagers say some very painful things sometimes. But most of us can hold on to, it's the parent's role to be the one to move past competitive victimhood and de-escalate because of the power dynamic that is held in the relationship. But in the heat of the moment, often we can't. And that's also true in places where power dynamics are maybe like more obscured, or we don't have as much agreement on them. Like I think about, so I live in Canada, and you know the dominant narrative is so much about reconciliation, but between the nation state of Canada and Indigenous peoples. But then when we actually like kind of get into the weeds, there can be this back and forth of like both sides. It's not really like a both sides got traumatized sort of story. It's a story of, you know, perpetrated abuse by a powerful party upon another party. But when we get stuck in this competitive victimhood thing, it means we're not able to acknowledge that. We're like not able to acknowledge that the reality is there is like one party that has the power to end the violence or to end the cycle. And that's really, really key for us to be able to start working on solutions to a lot of the social problems that we're experiencing out there.
And Kev, something you said earlier, it just is sticking in me so significantly. And I'm wondering if I can just name it. Is that like, you said the question of like, how much is needed to share? Like how much of our story, going back to the disclosure, like how much of the disclosure, how much do we need to tap into to be heard and seen? And I just keep going back to that because I recognize in performing in the Trauma Olympics, that we're taking maybe an experience that's in our bodies that resonates at a 7 and turning the volume up at a 10, hoping to be heard. But the volume or the decibel to which we might be expressing it and the actions we're doing, which is also isolating ourselves from other people or within our own group or within other groups, actually prevents us from being heard at all. Like if I'm screaming at a 10, and I want you to hear my natural voice, which is at a 5. You never actually hear my natural voice. You never get to hear the actual process within me that needs to be recognized. The freeze, the pain, the unexpressed fight response, the trauma.
And, you know, in some ways, maybe that is also a perpetuation of not being heard, of the trauma of not being heard. Mm. Because when I'm actually heard, I have to feel it too.
Right. Mm. Yeah. Mic drop.
Yeah. Mic drop indeed.
Yeah. You know, I know like some people who will talk in a kind of way that they literally cannot be heard. And when you actually slow them down and they're hurt, it's like they don't know what to do. It's like, okay, now that's not that narrative anymore. And I'm actually being heard. And what changes my identity, right? Like, are we willing to let go of these identities, that compulsive need to retell? Like, if we don't have a way to deal with the charge inside of us, that activation, intensity, arousal that comes out in that high volume, in the compulsive retelling, people need alternative ways to deal with that charge so that the story can be the story without that shh behind it, that geyser. And could we imagine a world just to say, I experienced something today and I felt scared. Could you be with me? Could you comfort me? Without telling the story. Like, could you imagine a world where people, there was enough spaciousness of time, people weren't stretched super thin, because you're competing for their time. They've got this, and you know, everybody is just stretched so thin. So just imagine that kind of spaciousness and those kind of relational connections where you didn't need to justify, you just needed to say, I'm feeling this and I need this, and it came. What might that feel like? How would our lives be different? What would be needed so that we could do that? If somebody said that to you, would you start asking questions? Would you need them to justify in a subtle kind of way because you need to prioritize your time and attention to be able to turn towards them?
I'm just soaking that in. I think what we're unpacking here is just so significant. Because again, as you're describing that in Kim, this world where we're just truly recognized and seen, where there's not this competition of resources for it. Like, we don't have to annihilate others. We don't have to create otherness. We don't have to create divide in hopes of being seen. We don't have to perpetuate fragmentation in the search for wholeness. And that's everything.
Yes, please. Sign me up. Is there space there for me? Can I join you?
I think you got a seat at the table.
Will there be snacks?
Oh, they said there'll be sex.
Oh, there could be sex too. Sex and
sex. They make you sex. Yeah.
Kai's like, I'm there.
Sex and snacks? What could be better?
Sex and snacks. That's the name of our next podcast.
I'll do that. Snacks.
Getting that on a t-shirt.
Oh my God.
Oh my gosh.
We still haven't gotten our t-shirt from the first episode. So if you want people to come back, you need to make the t-shirts.
That's true.
I think it was, the t-shirt was baby. Never text me again.
Yes, that's right. Never text me again.
But it was baby. Never text me again. Yeah, so we're still waiting, Scott. And if you haven't listened to that episode,
Kai,
baby
never
text me again. As a
follow-up from that episode, did he text you again?
He's never texted me again.
It's a powerful message.
It was. I have not heard from that guy. Never once.
We got some t-shirts coming up.
Okay.
Inkem and Kai, I love you so much. Thank you for coming on once again to the Gently Used Human podcast. I adore each of you and your wisdom and your transmission and normalization of being that beautiful, gently used human that we all are.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a mutual admiration club with sex and snacks.
With sex and snacks. Where can people find you? Where can people hang out with you in the world?
Kai, where are you in the world?
Oh, God. I don't know. I mean, on the internet. I would say
interwebs.
People find you on the internet?
Interwebs. Yeah. You know, I just had a book come out. And so maybe if people really wanted to get like a sense of me and also more on this topic, really, I would invite folks to check out Falling Back and Being Love with Human, Letters to Lost Souls, my most recent book. You can get it at, you know, any place where books are sold, really. And then also, you can find me on Instagram at KaiChengTom if you really want. Instagram? I'm not so sure how I'm feeling about Instagram these days, but you can find me there, at least for now.
I have to say, I've run into many people who follow you, Kai, on Instagram, and they go, wait, you know Kai? And they're like, I follow her on Instagram and she's changed my life. So I hear that we might have issues with social media, as we do.
Yes.
But it is also a platform to which people can find you and resonate.
Yes, they can. It's true.
Wisdom.
It's true. Thank you.
So I just want to put it out there.
It's true.
In fact, Inkem and I were together when someone told us that.
You were?
When they were talking about you.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's wild.
Mm-hmm. And Inkem, where in the world can people find you, connect with you, study with you?
All the usual places. So on the interwebs, my organization is Lumos Transforms for the Harry Potter fans. Pre-turfing Harry Potter fan. Lumos is that spell where you get to light your wand.
Oh, that's the
light spell. Everyone has a wand and you light your wand. It's like we're making magic there. So Lumos Transforms. And you know the usual Instagram. What is that? I refuse to say the new name for Twitter. That place too.
X. XXX. Oh, that shall not be spoken of.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And where can people find you? Can you say your handle?
Oh, Inkem Ndefo. NKEMNDEF, as in Frank. Oh, do you think I spell that often? Yes.
Amazing. Thank you both for your beautiful wisdom. And thank you all for tuning in to The Gently Used Human. Check out Inkem and Kai and all the amazing work they're doing in the world. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to The Gently Used Human podcast with Dr. Scott Lyons and friends. Visit gentlyused.com for fun extras, including submitting your questions for advice from a Midwestern mom. And don't forget to spill the tea and gossip about the show with all your friends and frenemies. And show some love by giving us 5 stars and leaving a review in your favorite apps. This helps us connect with all the other gently used humans out there. Oh, and by the way, you look fierce today.